attending the AFM. In what capacity,
both,
by the way?
Both. Okay. I was out in L.A.
Why were you in L.A. particularly? What was your precise business during AFM? What were you doing?
Well, I have a film I'm making here that I went out there to meet with some distributors who had contacted me about the film.
All right.
And I've never been to AFM I've been there as a movie fan, you know, attending screenings, but I've never been as a filmmaker where I had to actually go buy the badge and walk the floors at AFM and meet the distributors and see what, you know, they were offering and what they were selling. And so it was a different perspective, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So,
all right, so you're talking to people in the course of discussing a film that you're looking to put together. Are you looking to direct it or produce it, or what are you going to do?
Well, I've written the script. I'm directing it. I'm editing it. I'm co-sharing the co-producing credits.
Okay.
It's an anthology film I'm doing called Bayou Tales.
Okay. Bayou Tales. That's very resonant. That stays in the mind, stays in the heart. So, is it present day?
Oh, yeah. It's
post-Katrina?
Yeah, well, one of the stories takes place during Katrina, actually.
Okay.
And it was based on a news report that was down here.
Okay.
That I happened upon. It's sort of in the vein of Tales from the Crypt, Twilight, more Twilight Zone than Tales from the Crypt.
All right. Okay. One thing that I, so let's just go over the basics here. I am now cresting along on a Wolf of Wall Street high as a result of yesterday afternoon's screening at the West Side Pavilion, which was concurrently going on in New York. I mean, there's been Guild screenings all during the past week, but this is the first time press took a look at it. And I believe that it's masterful, and it really is Scorsese Satyricon, and that it's that anybody that goes to this film, which is a rollicking, mad, orgiastic tale of Jordan Belfort's rise and fall in the 90s on Wall Street, and particularly as the head of Stratton Oakmont. Pump and dump, stock fraud, wild abandon in terms of drugs, naked women, theft of tens of millions of dollars. It is Scorsese Satyricon, and you can't go to this film and say, well, I didn't like a character, or I didn't find it warm and fuzzy enough. I wanted to, you know, feel emotion. I wanted to tear up a little bit. It's just not on that level at all, you know. But people nonetheless do go to the movies and they say, that's what I want from a motion picture experience. I want to, you know, feel a little emotional tug, a little, you know. And those are the people that are going to respond and have responded apparently to Saving Mr. Banks. And I guess to some extent, the more, you know, conventional films, the Gravity and whatnot. By the way, I heard a really scary thing from a friend about an actor, a name-level actor. Just dropping the Wolf of Wall Street point just for 1 second. He watched on a screener All Is Lost and said to my friend, I'm not going to say who the friend is, I'm not going to say who the actor is, but he's a pretty well-known guy. He turned off All Is Lost after about 10 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. He said, why should I? I mean, you can see what this thing is. There's no dialogue, and he's just going to do this, and he's going to do that, and he's going to try. He didn't care. He just turned it off. And I said, holy God. You know.
Jeff, unfortunately, that seems a lot of people, and I've talked to one of my friends, and he'll go nameless, but he's an Oscar-winning Best Picture producer.
Yeah.
And he rarely goes to the theater anymore. He's an older guy. He's in that demographic,
uh-huh,
you know, that you wrote about, white, you know, lives in the gated community,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Older guy in his 70s now.
Right.
And he looks at the screeners and he says, after 15 minutes, I'm not engaged. Next. You know? They get stacks of these things. So they're going through them, you know, almost like, oh, it's almost like picking up a Reader's Digest and trying to, you know, read the Reader's Digest version of, you know, epic novels or something. You know, they're just, they're flying through them. And I guess the ones that they like, they keep watching, and the ones they lose patience with. You know, people talk about, it's funny, people talk about younger people and that they have no, that they have ADD or ADHD and they don't have the patience. Frankly, you know, a lot of older folks I've talked to in the academy, they sit home and watch screeners and they just kind of, you know, 10, 15 minutes, boom, next.
Yeah. And they skip by the stuff that they don't want to see, which is why 12 Years a Slave is not going to penetrate on the screener level. You have to watch these things in the theater, and because of the screener thing, it's really a kind of a poisonous element that has inserted itself into the whole, you know, awards nominating process, because people are just aren't watching this stuff. They want to watch what they want to watch. The whole thing about submitting yourself to any work of that involves you know, reading dialogue or showing you images in a play or movie or whatever, you have to sit there and really get into it. You know, let yourself try to go with what they're presenting to you. But at home, it's, as you know, it's about, well, I don't know if I like this, I'm going to turn it off. You know, and that's it. And then nothing happens.
Or I got to go take a piss.
Yeah.
Let me pause the movie. Or let me get something to eat.
Yeah.
Or I'll come back to this later. Or the phone's ringing. Or,
yeah.
You know, distractions.
Right. It's really, I don't know what else to say. Is it? I know that they're going to push past a couple of scenes in Wolf of Wall Street right away when that gets around to being in screener form. I'm sure it will sooner or later. But it's, when do you anticipate, or when is the New Orleans crowd going to be seeing this film? I would think soon? No?
Yeah. American Hustle is Monday night.
Okay.
And Wolf is shortly thereafter.
Mm-hmm. American Hustle.
So, unless the screener pops in the mail today, or even Monday.
Right.
But, like, I'm picking up today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to watch Short Term 12, which I've heard nothing but great things about.
Okay.
Have you seen that?
I saw it earlier this year. I saw it Oh, that's right. It showed at first. The first screening was at South by Southwest in Austin in March. And I think I caught up with it sometime in May or something, May, June, somewhere around there. And I know the summer is when they did all the press and everything. So, yeah. It's I don't know that it's a great film. It's a pretty good one, though. I mean, there's no question that it's a good film. It's taken from the director's experience with wayward kids, you know, kids with authority problems, behavior issues, that kind of thing. And
well, Brie Larson is the one that's getting all the press, and I suppose in a year that's not so overflowing with high-end Best Actress nominees, she might have not a big chance or a great chance, but certainly an opportunity to land a nomination. But her best bet, I mean, she got nominated for a Spirit Award, I believe, wasn't she?
Yes. That's the realm that she's going to, that a performance like this from a film like this naturally defaults to.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Past?
I'm watching that tonight as well.
Well, I swear to God, I don't know how anybody... See, this is the thing. Nobody's really all that comprehensive in their watching of movies. They might see some of it, or they might not, but they tend not to. And basically, they just kind of follow the lead of what people they talk to at a party are saying about this or that. And there's no consistency. There's no real... disciplined commitment to seeing films. Berenice Bejo does a magnificent, not a very good, but a magnificent job in the lead female role. I mean, I don't see how anybody can dismiss it. And she was the toast of the town along with Jean Dujardin when The Artist was the big movie 2 years ago. And most people are going to ignore the past. They're not going to watch it. Nothing. And it's a superb film from the guy who made A Separation, Asghar Farhadi. Brilliant film.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to your favorite actress of the year from Blue is the Warmest Color.
Yeah. You seen that?
Oh, is this? I mean, I know that the Academy does vote for, obviously, mm-hmm. foreign actors and foreign actresses, but, right. they really would have to reach for mm-hmm. some of these pictures you're talking about right. because they don't have, like Glavion Rose had a lot of momentum behind it, and it did pretty well at the box office.
Right.
So,
right.
Unfortunately, that does come into the equation when they're voting for these things. They think about it. Am I going to vote for this obscure little movie just because she's so great in it, but no one's seen it, mm-hmm. or do I vote for, Meryl Streep again?
Mm-hmm. So, have you seen, how many of the likely Best Picture nominees have you seen in your own? Have you seen 12 Years yet?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
And you're going to see Wolf of Wall Street fairly soon, as you just said, American Hustle.
The only ones I haven't seen are American Hustle and Wolf of Wall Street.
Okay.
That's only because they haven't, shown here.
All right.
Which is the only problem living in, a city like this, is that, you get stuff a little later.
Right.
But not too late. But
okay.
I did catch, when I was in Los Angeles, You'll be proud of this. I actually went to the Lemley Theater in Santa Monica
uh-huh.
and paid to see All Is Lost on your recommendation, Jeff.
Yeah. What was your impression of the film?
Well, I mean, I thought it was an amazing, for such a small budgeted picture. I think you made it for like $6 million or something.
Mm-hmm.
I was very impressed with, shooting on water is the, I don't care if it's inside the place where Cameron shot Titanic, and mm-hmm. you can't control 100% of the conditions, and that's always...
Well, they did a lot of it actually outside of, what I understand, it's not just Fox Baja, they did go out on the water.
Oh, yeah.
Here
in fact, do you know that when you get production insurance,
yeah.
the very first question they ask you, are you shooting on the water?
Yeah. You're right.
Huh. It drives up the insurance budget enormously, but no, I thought, for a movie, it reminded me when Hitchcock was making his films, and he would want to make
Lifeboat.
Something,
Lifeboat.
For lack of a better word, experimental.
Right. Yeah.
And like Lifeboat
mm-hmm.
is a good
mm-hmm.
example.
Right.
Lifeboat has a lot of characters and dialogue.
Yeah.
The whole thing takes place on that damn boat.
Mm-hmm.
You never leave the boat, which is, or rope, or something like that.
Right.
So
right.
from that vantage point, I thought, this is a really good movie. Really, technically, very well made. The effects were very good. I mean, I just thought it just worked all around.
Right.
And I thought Redford, was that's the best thing he's ever done.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
No question, hands down.
Yeah.
It's so hard. People think acting is all about saying witty dialogue,
mm-hmm.
and that's not the case at all. The subtlety in his performance. It really came across, and by the way, I never thought the ending was ambiguous.
You didn't.
In fact, I thought it was quite the opposite. I thought it was obvious.
You felt that the white light indicated what it indicated is what you mean.
It was a boat coming to get him.
Oh, okay. No, I mean, other people would say absolutely no ambiguity. The fact that he takes the hand of somebody and then it goes to white, that means, the white light of infinity, of eternity.
No, no.
Well, that's what the white light tends to signify.
Well,
people talk about a little white light at the end of a tunnel, you get the bright white light of God's eternal love.
But then the black light at the end of The Sopranos is like the antithesis of that.
Well, that's David Chase's way of regarding the finality of death. But
white is heaven, black is hell.
No, I mean...
Tony's going.
I think that he decided to float it a little bit and let people play with it and let it be ambiguous. But as I posted the final page of his original 31 pages or whatever it was that he wrote in 2011 that he sent to Redford, there's no question that in the final page of his treatment, it's rescue without a doubt. So. But that's the way I took it. I took it
as personal experience. Yeah. Years ago, I was hired to do a documentary on oil rig workers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was flown out to the Gulf, I mean way out in the Gulf, mm-hmm. and I was on one of those super rigs.
Right.
And you get out there on the platform and where the helicopters land where we're filming, and you look around on a 360,
mm-hmm.
and literally there's nothing but water. Nothing. Not even another rig. Nothing. Mm-hmm. And the movie All Is Lost captured that almost what I would call exterior claustrophobia.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Where you look around, there's just nothing there. And then I've also read firsthand accounts of guys who got stranded out in the water, and they see, you know, well, didn't a boat pass by? They said, shit, 10 boats passed by. None of them picked me up. They didn't see them. So, and I thought the film did a great job of showing that when he was out there trying to get someone's attention, and you just realize when they're on these super ships, these you know, these international these shipping lanes, these enormous ships,
uh-huh.
they're not looking for survivors. They're not looking for people lost. They're just, you know, they're more concerned with, you know, making their schedule.
Yeah.
Now they're so, and it's just so damn hard to spot one individual. I mean, I have a friend who works for the Coast Guard down here, mm-hmm. who does a lot of rescues out in the Gulf and Lake Pontchartrain here,
mm-hmm.
and he said it's just, people don't realize how just to find one individual, you know, is just almost impossible, which is why a lot of these search and rescue things end up tragically, unfortunately.
Well, I took it as a metaphor that the big corporate tankers are, I mean, he's not like a mile or two away from them. They go almost right by him immediately, and they don't even, I took that as a metaphor that they don't have a lot of interest in the individual.
That's an interesting perspective. Mm-hmm. I never thought of it that way, but, you know, yeah, that's certainly one way.
I mean, there's three times when a ship goes by and nothing happens? I mean,
that despair,
yeah.
and loneliness set in, mm-hmm. and you realize,
right.
you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah.
Right.
So yeah, I mean it's actually a very scary thought.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
to be out there. I mean, you know, the film that I remember that gave me that kind of feeling was what was the name of the film with the couple that got stranded scuba diving and the sharks got them?
Yeah.
Open water. Yeah. I've never watched that film twice. It gives me the creeps. Because, you know, obviously it did happen. Actually, the couple that it's based on are from Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
That it happened to. But yeah, that's just one of the most terrifying things you can imagine. Because you've lost all control, you know.
Right, yeah. Now,
the only thing I was questioning, logic-wise, and all is lost, a lot of those boats, and again, this comes from my background in making these documentaries, they have these things called EPIRBs on the boats. And as soon as the boat sinks, that EPIRB signals to, you know, the Coast Guard, and it goes up to the satellites.
Yes.
And it tells you the exact location where the boat is, where it went down. And they're supposed to send out rescue parties.
Mm-hmm.
But since there was no dialogue in the film, there was no way of explaining, well, I guess he didn't have one on the boat. You know, but that was the only thing from a technical viewpoint that bothered me. But other than that, I thought the film was terrific.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So here's the here's a thought that came to me last night. I did this last year. Since you've seen all but two of them, we could play this game a little bit, but I did this last year. I basically said, let's play the Howard Hawks game. The Howard Hawks game is that great films, you know, great, very good, excellent films are defined by, they always have three great scenes and no bad ones. So you look at any of the nominees and ask yourself, which are the three great scenes that it has? I mean, like, three. What are great scenes to you? The great scenes are the ones that you talk about with your friends. That was really something, right? The ones that really deliver, you know, the truth bombs. The yep, that's the way it is, all right. Yep, that hit home, you know. Really nailed it, you know.
Well, okay, so let's say if you were to take the top contenders.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You want to start with.
Yeah, we'll start with Captain Phillips. You've seen that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Everybody says that the big scene in that, which is in fact what seems to cement the belief that Tom Hanks' performance is the best actor caliber, is the end when those guys get shot and he responds to the shock and the horror of being right next to murder and death, bullets and death, and then being debriefed by that woman. That last, what is that, last 10 minutes or so.
Right.
That's a good, great moment, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, what are the other two great scenes?
None.
I honestly wonder. I don't think there's anything else that's great other than that. I mean, I don't even know that that's great. What that is effective. That's very that stays with you. So let's call it great. Fine. Okay, it's a great scene. What beyond that though? Be honest.
Well, I'm again, my personal opinion. Very good movie.
Yeah.
Very entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
But given Greengrass's, you know, experience making these types of films,
mm-hmm.
nothing new.
Yeah.
And you know, United 93, more memorable.
I thought so. I honestly thought that the last Bourne film was even though it's a Bourne movie, I thought that was a much, much better film than what we're talking about here. I thought it was just good. It was a good film. But it wasn't a great
film. Guess what you might call back in the day workmanlike.
Yeah.
You know, very proficient.
Yeah.
Very well done, very well shot,
mm-hmm.
very well edited. But, you know, you're almost, if you know anything about Greengrass's work, you're almost expecting that.
Yeah.
When you go in.
Right. Right.
So, you know, so yeah, I mean, I liked the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was, I don't know if I'd put it in my top 10,
mm-hmm.
to be honest.
Okay. All right, so we don't agree that there's three great scenes. There's one great scene, okay?
Right.
Okay, so moving beyond that, there is American Hustle you haven't seen. Spike Jonze as Her, you've seen that?
Yes.
Do you think that has three great scenes?
I'd say it has at least one.
Which is?
Well, I mean, I really like it's hard for me to talk about that because I don't want to, you know, how close do we have to talk about this in terms of, you know, like.
Well, there's a scene in the trailer. It's been clipped in which he has this argument with his ex, played by Rooney Mara, and she says to him, "So you're in love with your computer?" And he says, "She's not a computer. She's more than that." And he's sincere. I think that's a really interesting scene because he is talking about software, but he is talking about a very delicate, emotional, profound emotional connection that he's feeling, and he really is in love in a way that means something to him, in as much as any love affair that any person has ever felt. And I felt that was really.
I mean, that's a movie that I thought had brilliant production design, and I thought Joaquin was very effective. In fact, I liked him a lot in the film, more so than I've liked him in, you know, other movies.
Yeah.
He's very appealing.
Yeah. Wasn't that even as geeky as before? He was been kind of geeky in films past.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wasn't as moved by the film. I know you really loved it.
Well, it's really a love story, though. I mean, it is a love story.
Yeah.
A profound love story.
So I don't know.
What you're telling me.
Is that talked about as making the cut for the top eight or nine movies?
I think it definitely is there. Sure. I mean, it may not be reflected by the Stasi Academy, but I think that it's it's really hard to not say that's one of the ones that really does something fresh and moving. And well, you didn't believe he was in love? You thought it was too bizarre, the idea of software? You didn't believe it?
Well, I mean, I didn't think it was like Lars and the Real Girl for me.
Oh! Okay. That movie does not work on it for me at all on that level, but okay, all right, I hear you.
Okay.
That's a destructive thing to say.
Well, I like Lars and the Real Girl. I liked her, but I didn't.
All right.
It's hard for me to relate to a character that's, you know, wants to have sex with a computer or have sex with a living doll.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I thought it was an interesting conceit. But again, I think Spike is an artist. I think he's extraordinarily talented. And I think the movie's going to get some nominations.
But Dave, it's not that much of a conceit. I mean, we all know that many, many people, for them, falling in love, falling in like, discovering great amounts of, you know, sympathy and compassion and eroticism, all that stuff happens online now. So it's not at all a big leap to presume that you could really fall in love and without having to, you know, a lot of people do this. This is completely normal, so it's not at all a stretch. I mean, the only thing that Lars and the Real Girl is about a guy who's got a love doll, right?
Yeah.
So there's no personality here. We've got Scarlett Johansson inhabiting and not just an interesting lady who's very sharp and really knows her stuff, knows him really well and scans all his information. But she grows, you know. She's not just the way a girlfriend of anywhere would evolve and change, and you know, she's just not a static figure. She's a woman who is open to new information, new experience, new insights. So it's not really that much of a stretch. Whereas Lars and the Real Girl, the perversity of Lars and the Real Girl is quite simple and plain, and he's playing this kind of beefy guy with a flannel shirt, and he's kind of a simpleton. Wow, I didn't think it was on that level at all.
Well, I'm just thematically, I just thought it was, you know, that's what. And again, I didn't dislike the movie. Again, there's a lot to admire in it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's. I think he could very possibly get a screenplay nomination, maybe a director nomination. I mean, the director's branch is a real squirrely bunch, boy. They really they go out on a limb, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, who foresaw those two nominations last year? Well, certainly the one for Ben Zeitlin, and then knocking off mm-hmm. Catherine Bigelow and Ben Affleck.
Yeah,
you know. So
right,
but all right. What's next? What's next on the list?
Well,
Howard Hawks test.
Oh, well, do you think there are three great scenes in Inside Llewyn Davis?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I do, yeah. I mean, I could list any number of them, but there's...
I mean, if they nominated a serious man, they're definitely going to nominate this. You know, this is a warmer version of a serious man.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I know you and I have exchanged emails about the cat.
It's a, you know, it's funny, you said it's a warmer version. The tone of Inside Llewyn Davis, you know, with its somber palette, kind of grayish, you know,
yeah. It's
desaturated, and the wintry climate.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a little ironic, but, excuse me, it's a little ironic because you're right, it's set in the dead of winter, and the palette is very muted and gray, but I just found that the film has a lot on its mind, and a lot of it makes a lot of very interesting points about,
right.
You know, somebody said a talented man who can't get out of his own way and doesn't have the talent to make money off his talent, which is really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there's...
And I love that scene with... I mean, you were talking about three great scenes. I mean, there's many in this film, but
mm-hmm.
the Please, Mr. Kennedy song
is
great.
Yep.
the scene with F. Murray Abraham, the scene with John Goodman. I mean, it's almost like everyone's little cameo pieces. The scene in the park with Carey Mulligan.
Yeah.
I mean, the scene in the coffee shop. I mean,
yeah.
The scene where he goes to get. I mean, it's just on and on. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah.
I really, really love the movie. And I've watched it now twice, and I'm going to probably watch it a third time.
Mm-hmm. I've seen it like 4 times, 5 times, something like that.
Yeah, it's just, it resonates.
Mm-hmm. It's a very complete, thorough, well-built world that is completely, you know, it really is completely believable. But I'll bet that the same person who turned off Robert Redford after 10 minutes, he's probably going to go, kind of a downer, you know, and turn it off after 20 minutes. Who knows? I mean, it's just... I don't know what to say to people anymore.
I don't know either, man, but I found it incredibly watchable. And it had a sense of humor. Maybe that'll stick with people.
Yeah.
It's funny because every time Lewin opens his mouth to sing, you want to embrace him. But every time he's not singing and opens his mouth, you want to punch him.
Yeah, yeah. He's, it's funny, he's a guy who could theoretically, if someone just gets to him and say, listen, drop traditional folk and start... pulling elements of your own life, your own experience, and redefine yourself by singing folk, but folk stuff about your own life, you know, and about right now, rather than traditional, you know, Woody Guthrie stuff, riding the rails, you know, which in other words, do what Dylan is doing, and something might start to happen, be different. And that guy is, you know, for whatever, you know, just luck, life. His muse is not there, and he's not going to do that. He's just not going to see that light, and that's why he's leaving, and that's why he's in the Merchant Marines. And it's kind of a downer in a way. You know, it's a guy who's got talent and a kind of vision, but it's the wrong vision at the wrong time.
Right.
Yeah.
It reminds me of what Mark Ruffalo told Kenny Lonergan when he saw the uncut version of Margaret.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Kenny, it's a masterpiece. That's the good news. The bad news is you're in the wrong country in the wrong decade.
If this were, say, in France or something, in the 70s or 60s, is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Right. Okay, Dallas Buyers Club.
I don't know, Margaret in the 60s in France. It's a masterpiece.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Dallas Buyers Club. 3 great scenes in that.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
I really love this movie also.
Mm-hmm.
Jared Leto's scene where he goes to see his father.
Yeah.
Most heartbreaking scene of the year.
Yeah.
Hands down.
Yeah. The scene where I thought that there's so many different... I mean, there's every scene seems to matter. Every scene in Dallas Buyers Club seems to add a little bit more weave to the fabric. It seems to, you know, really just, there's no one scene that I notice that just kind of happens and, you know, it's interesting, but you move on. Everything that happens in that film brings a little something more to the totality of what the film is about. So.
Absolutely. And if you know anything about the backstory on the making of the film, it's just a fascinating
history
behind it. And I think the Academy likes those kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And also, on a personal experience, that was shot here, a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine has a house uptown, and I was picking up actually some props for my movie,
mm-hmm.
and he said, yeah, come on over, but you have a tough time parking because they're filming this Matthew McConaughey movie next door to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I knew it was Dallas Buyers Club, so mm-hmm. I went there,
mm-hmm.
and I parked, and not maybe half a block from his house, and I get out.
Mm-hmm.
I look around, and I'm telling you, there's no fence separating my friend's house from the house they were shooting at.
Yeah.
There was no security, no trucks. I didn't even see one, what they call, you know, a grip and lighting truck.
Mm-hmm.
No trailers. There's maybe 15 people on the set.
Yeah.
And if I hadn't seen, you know, I think they were using the red camera, I would have sworn it was a student film.
Yeah.
Well, except for Matthew McConaughey being there. But I was looking around and said, Jesus, this is a movie set? You know, it was so laid back, no no big companies, no big crews, no nothing. And then I read a story about how they didn't even have a lighting package on the film. They didn't have a gaffer. They just shot it with available lights and whatever was on hand. And I just thought that was amazing, to be honest.
They shot the dinner scene where he gives Jennifer Garner the painting in that restaurant with available light, is what I'm told.
Yeah, well, the whole movie was shot with available light. Mm. They just did it that way. Well, because they didn't have time.
You have to ask yourself, we've
25
all been,
days to shoot the film.
How many times have we heard, you got to have this, you got to have a gaffer, you got to have the trucks? I don't know that that's really necessary.
I can tell you from making my film, budgeted, a lot less than what they shot theirs for, but, you don't need, I saw on Nebraska, Alexander Payne, that interview with Bruce Stern, he said he had 85 people on the set for the crew, and I'm thinking, why? You don't need 85 people.
Right.
You need a good 20 to 25 for sure, but beyond that, unless you're on a Michael Bay set,
right?
It's just and unless you're employing Teamsters, with lots of trailers and lots of security.
That's what the traditional Hollywood thing is. You employ a lot of people from various unions and groups that have staked their place in the community, and they expect to be hired, and that's the whole thing. And I think that things have changed, and particularly since it's not a a lot of smaller films don't make the money that they might hope for.
Well, on another filmmaker on the same vein, I know you're a big Kubrick aficionado.
Yeah.
You know the story when Tom Cruise walked on the first day of Eyes Wide Shut?
Yeah.
There's like six people there. He's like, where is everybody?
Uh-huh.
And they said, this is it. He's like, what do you mean this is it?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Stanley sent everyone home. He's like, why? He's like, well, the sets are built. They're lit. He just, and that's how Kubrick could shoot these films for months or even a year, is because he didn't retain, 100 people every day.
Right. But don't you need lights to be adjusted? You at least need people to readjust or play with lighting.
Kubrick oftentimes would do that himself because he was a photographer.
Right. Okay. Well, that's the way to do it.
Another great story where he walked on the set, Sidney Pollack. He was shooting a scene with Sidney Pollack, and Kubrick kept insisting the lights have been changed.
Yeah.
And they said, no, Stanley, we didn't touch the lights. No, the lights have been changed. It's off by an eighth of a stop.
Uh-huh.
And he could tell just from his eye that it was off a little bit. And sure enough, when they did the, when they did another light reading, it was off an eighth of a stop.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But anyway. All right, so back to the list, the Howard Hawks test.
All right, well, what's left? We haven't talked about did you feel that, I think 12 Years a Slave, without question, has three great scenes. I mean, the sex scene alone, the brief sex scene with that woman, I thought that was amazing.
The scene where he's hanging from the tree.
Yeah, we're poor.
It
Lupita.
Goes on and on and on forever.
Yeah, we're poor Lupita Nyong'o. I thought that when he pays back, when that wonderful moment of payback when he beats down Paul Dano. Even though I don't know if that's a great scene, but it sure was a satisfying scene. I said, oh, thank God. I mean, all that emotion that I felt, that it was so great to see Chiwetel hitting him back. I mean, I felt more satisfaction from that one scene with Paul Dano and Chiwetel than I did from all.
I actually thought that scene, that brief moment with Paul Giamatti when the camera's following him from room to room, and he's like...
Oh, that too, yeah.
That was great.
Yeah.
I thought that was really good.
Right.
All right, so Gravity, I guess consensus is we can say that has three great scenes in it.
Well, the three great scenes would be the initial horror of
the opening shot.
Of the opening shot. Yeah, that grandeur of the emotion, and then the then when the debris starts to hit and all that. But I honestly got to tell you, I felt that the camera was more and Alfonso Cuarón, actually, I felt there's something in which he got hit by everything that they could think of because they wanted to keep the energy levels up. They wanted to keep the thrill and danger and oh my God element up all the time. I didn't feel any kind of Kubrickian detachment at all. I felt that there was a determination to entertain and thrill people. And I...
So it was the Poseidon Adventure in outer space, but with one person.
Well, that's not too far off the mark, in my opinion. That's not fair to, an Irwin Allen film from 1973 or whatever.
Yeah.
That's kind of...
No, but I mean, they kept bringing in, when all else fails, let's kill off another character and get some more water.
Yeah,
I think Gravity is technically astonishing, and I think that's where it's going to pick up its awards.
What did at the end of every after saying cut at the end of every scene that he would shoot? What was Irwin Allen famous for saying?
I don't know. I give up.
Is everyone okay?
That's funny. Yeah.
What a shoveler of horseshit that guy was. But he was a real entertainer. You know. Anyway, so there's no so I basically feel that I could list quite a few scenes from Wolf of Wall Street that are easily down in the classic great scene moment that you will hang on to. I think that there is easily three in American Hustle you could point to.
Nebraska?
Which one? Sorry.
Nebraska.
Oh, Nebraska. Sorry. We should be paying attention to that. What are the three great scenes in Nebraska? Well, without question, in my view, anyway, it's very, very quiet. This is what's so effective about Nebraska. I feel at the very end, when Will Forte has purchased the pickup truck to give his father that sense of pride that he's been looking for the whole movie.
Sure.
And when Bruce Dern has, he's basically riding in the truck and, next to him, before he's taken the wheel, and he looks over at Will Forte and in a lesser director's hands, perhaps he might have that moment of looking at my son, who I never realized had the heart that he does, and he's actually a good guy, and I love him, and all that. He doesn't do any of that. He just kind of looks at him, and then looks away, But you can sense, you can tell that on Bruce Dern, because he's such a good actor, that he's thinking all that stuff, but he's not going to go there, because he's gruff, and he slurps beer, he's an alcoholic, he's not in the business of being expressive with his emotions, but he's definitely had that moment with his son. I thought that was a really good scene. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, a lot of people will point to the... Let's call it the June Squibb nomination scene.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah, you can all go fuck yourselves. That was a good one. Definitely.
Yeah.
How about the scene where they're all sitting in front of the television like corpses and they don't move and they just sit there and stare at the television? To me, that was certainly vivid. I'm never going to forget that. When I think of that film, I think of that moment. I don't know if it's great, but it's certainly lasting.
A lot of people, I guess you obviously thought very highly of the film. I thought, for me, I found the film lacking in some spots. I wasn't as crazy about Will Forte's performance as some people seem to be. But I thought Dern was wonderful. And I thought, the cinematography and the way it was shot was beautiful. And it had a Last Picture Show kind of quality to it.
Yeah. So Will Forte's character, though, he's a pretty passive fellow. He doesn't have a lot of guts and vinegar in him.
It's not the character. It's just the way he portrayed the character. I just didn't think he was... I just found his line readings. And I guess I just found some of the actors he chose, some of the choices Payne made.
Yeah.
I don't know if these people are actors or just people in these towns that he's recruited.
I think brothers are real guys, aren't they? The fat guys? The disgusting.
Yeah, I don't know if they're real brothers, though. I think they're But I just found some of their, again, some of the line readings on some of these other characters. I mean, when Stacy Keach showed up, I was like, oh, there you go, an actor.
Yeah.
A real actor.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's a respectable film, but I don't think it's a great film. I think compared to Payne's other films, I think, I mean, Bruce Dern's performance, obviously, clearly, front runner. I mean, in terms of the film itself, why I would recommend it, because his performance is so strong. And again, it's very subtle. It's like Redford's in All Is Lost.
I don't think it's a lead
performance. And Dern is not known for subtlety, to be honest.
I've never thought it's a lead. I mean, a lead is a lead. There's a way of defining and describing a lead performance. He is not delivering a lead performance. He's doing a very strong performance of a character who is essentially not carrying the weight of the film. He is the weight of the film. He is the burden of Wilford's life, Will Forte's life, and he's the guy with the ailment or the affliction or the problem or the blockage, whatever you want to call it. But he never acts on anything. He has a moment of compassion or thankfulness. He opens up emotionally at the end. He feels grateful. He feels complete, which is nice. But it's not, if it's a lead, it's a very oddly defined lead. I mean, I'm not going to argue it strenuously, but all my impression is that he's not really a lead. But the issue, by the force of Paramount's determination, by their will, that they're insisting that it is a lead, they're campaigning it as such. So everybody's bought into it. So the argument is kind of moot at this point. But I guess, I'll never deny that it was a lead. Not really. But I do like the performance.
The other film we should discuss, I'm thinking, is Philomena, because I think that's picking up a lot of momentum. Is that what you're getting?
If it is, it's news to me. I know that she's doing very nicely as a likely. Judi Dench is doing very well as a likely Best Actress contender. But I found it rather, because Steve Coogan decided, along with his co-writing partner, is it Jeff Pope, I think, they decided to pull back a little bit. You know, there's a Kyle Smith said that this is an anti-Catholic rant of a film, and that's exactly how Variety's critic Justin Chang described it. You know, I felt it wasn't anti-Catholic enough.
First of all, I'm a Catholic.
Yep.
Last Catholic.
Yep.
When I saw the film, I think I'm intelligent enough to look at a film and say it's not anti-Catholic. It's against a small sect of the Catholic faith that did something horrific during this time frame.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it's anti-Catholic. In fact, Judi Dench's character, who is Catholic, projects the best sense of Catholicism by what she does at the end of the film.
By forgiving them?
Let me get my drift.
Yeah, she forgives them. The Mother Superior, who made the call, who was pretty much the most demonic figure amongst all the nuns at this convent in Ireland, she forgives them. And I felt that was, that might be very Catholic, but I didn't feel that they warranted forgiveness. And they weren't being
that's why Judi Dench tells Steve Coogan, do you know how difficult this is for me to say that?
Uh-huh.
And if you don't understand that, then you're not getting what I'm about and my faith is about. Which I thought was great. That was a wonderful scene, that film.
Right.
And Coogan's response is, of course, what Coogan is like your stand-in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had that great line, I wish Jesus would come in here and tip you over in your fucking wheelchair.
Yeah. That's how I felt, you know, and I just felt it was, and he threw in the forgiveness thing because he wanted Philomena to be the embodiment of a better form of a much more charitable and kindly and more Christ-like behavior, view of life, way of dealing with transgressors and horrible things. So
I think if the older, we talked about the older Academy faction.
Yeah.
They're going to go for this movie in a big way.
Okay.
I think. If, you know, I don't think they'll have a problem sitting through it. I mean, I think it's, She's great. I don't know how crowded the adapted screenplay category is, but Coogan, you know, they could certainly have a legit shot at the screenplay nomination. Frears is well liked, respected. You know, not that he's going to get in as director, but I think the movie has a very good chance of landing in that top 8 or 9 slots.
And did we discuss Saving Mr. Banks? I've forgotten.
Well, you know, that's the film that to me is, you know, if you're going to look at a movie that is in the Academy's wheelhouse, that's the one. You know, if they can acknowledge Gravity's technical accomplishments, but they, and they look at 12 Years a Slave and maybe throw Lupita and John Ridley an award or Steve McQueen, I think the director's is down to McQueen and Cuarón.
Yeah.
I think Saving Mr. Banks is their Chariots of Fire winner. You know, heartwarming period piece. You know, that's that. You know, and then throw in, I guess, the Academy's recent selections of The Artist and Argo. Hollywood loves movies about making movies. You know, showing the.
Yeah.
You know, and again, the Walt Disney connection. I mean, Walt Disney. No movie associated with Disney has ever won a Best Picture, has it? I don't think it has.
Okay.
So, I mean, I just think that if they're going to give it something they can get behind, it's a safe, conservative, middle-brow, you know, kind of movie that they can embrace. And I think that they will. That
so tell me the three great scenes, though.
Too harsh for them. Three great scenes.
In Saving Mr. Banks.
I happen to think the scene where she, well, certainly I think one of the highlights, not only of the movie, but I think one of the best written scenes of the year is the scene where he goes to London and sits down with her and tells her about his dad.
I'll buy that. That's a good scene. That's a good scene.
That's a beautifully written scene.
Yeah. But what's he basically saying? He's saying that it's better to kind of paper over the rather painful and brutal and rather, you know, quite unpleasant memories, the reality of what we went through as kids, you know, and to, you know, kind of like put some sugar on it and make things a little nicer than they actually were, because who wants to go through all that crap again? That's basically what he's saying, right?
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, oh yeah, I get it. I think, you know, I like the scene where they, I mean, I know it's a payoff scene because she's been such a bitch to them, but the scene where she kind of starts to turn and they sing Go Fly a Kite together, I thought was a sweet scene, a wonderful scene.
Yeah.
I think the first scene she has with Hanks, I think Hanks is terrific in the film. I mean, she's being talked about, but he's wonderful in the movie. He does, I think, an excellent job as Disney. I was very impressed with him, you know.
He's a very warm and jovial and yet clearly a willful fellow who gets what he wants, and you know, but that's not, it's not really a very honest, you know, presentation. I thought that was kind of phony about the whole thing about not being able to show cigarettes and you know.
Yeah, I mean, I did notice the coughing, you know, the incessant coughing he does throughout the film.
Yeah.
Sort of hinting at his future, very future demise.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that is it a great film? No, but I think it's a very good film.
Yeah.
And but just more importantly, if you take yourself Jeff's viewpoint and shift it over to the Academy's viewpoint, that's the kind of film that you know they can, you know, they're going to go for.
Yeah.
I mean, 12 Years is just, I think, as beautifully made as that film is, it's just too harsh for them. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that there just isn't. I mean, what really surprised me is that the New York film critics didn't stand up for 12 Years a little more than they did. I know that McQueen won with director, but I was really surprised that Lupita Nyong'o did not win the New York Film Critics. I thought that would be a absolute, no question, has to be done, slam dunk. And they went with Jennifer Lawrence instead, and she's very spirited, and she's very colorful and quite memorable in her performance in American Hustle. She's no question. She's a lot of fun. She really nails it. But it's in terms of something that really penetrates and stays with you, something that's the kind of performance that it's just impossible to forget or dismiss. I'm amazed that they blew off Lupita Nyong'o. That tells me that there are some people, even among the New York film critics, which are much more of a consensus group than it used to be. It used to be a little tougher and stronger group than it did, because they've let more people in. So I'm surprised. But I don't know what's going to happen with 12 Years. They have to get more critics groups to stand by it. And the next hope, I guess, is LA Film Critics. I think it's this coming...